Hello, good evening. I'm Dr. Randall Brewer, and welcome to another edition of Health Matters here on listener-supported Red River Radio. As you may know, the COVID-19 pandemic continues. Cases apparently are again on the rise, and developments do change quickly. So it's time to bring you yet another update on the COVID-19 pandemic here in the Arklatex. Again tonight, I am very honored and privileged to be joined by Dr. G.E. Golly, Chancellor of LSU Health here in Shreveport, to give us his take on the COVID-19 pandemic in our area. And we will give you guys an update on the various treatments, research, and statistics as it pertains to the COVID-19 pandemic here in North Louisiana. As always, as you know, this is a listener-supported show, and we enjoy to hear your comments and answer your questions. And you can call us at 1-800-552-8502, or you can tweet at RRR Public Radio. Dr. Golly, good to have you back with us tonight.
Hey, Dr. Brewer. It's my honor to be on with you.
So, the last time we spoke, we were having a conversation about, the COVID-19 pandemic, and, we've had quite an uptick in initial cases here in Northwest Louisiana, especially Caddo Parish. And we had, initiated some measures to modify our curve, and we were having success with that. How do things stand now?
Well, we're better than we were in the early part of the pandemic, say, March, mid-March to mid-April. But we've lost a little bit of ground in the last, I would say, 2 to 3 weeks. You're correct, Randy. We've had an uptick in cases. As a matter of fact, if you look just in the last week, we've had an increase by over 10,000 in cases reported. Not all of that can be attributed to increased testing. There's been a slight increase in the positivity by about 1% overall around the state. So not only are the number of cases increasing, but the number of positives within the cohort that's being tested is going up as well.
Do we think that has any relationship to the measures the governor has taken to open, our economy up?
Well, I think it's been a combination of things. Part of it is the announcement, that the governor made that was effective June 5th, I believe, that moved Louisiana into phase two, which was, a very measured and calculated decision on his part based on discussing the incidence of cases with the healthcare experts, the epidemiologists, as well as the people in the Department of Health. And I think that had part of, partly to do with it. We expected that there was going to be an increase in the incidence of cases once the restrictions were lifted. They weren't fully lifted, they were partially lifted from between phase one to phase two. But I think that was only part of it. I think the other part of it is due to some of the holidays that happened during that period of time. Most recently now, the 4th of July, which I think is now, just now beginning to rear its effects. We're looking at close to 2,000 additional cases a day, somewhere between 1,750 and 200 and 2,000 cases a day that are happening, that are being reported. I think maybe a small percentage of that can be attributed to our testing. Louisiana's doing a pretty darn good job at testing. I mean, we're number three in the United States fairly consistently. If I look at my numbers from yesterday and the day before that. Today, we're number three in the country in number of tests per capita, test per individual, test, you know, per population. We're number three in the country, which is a good number. That's a good number to be high on. I think that has something to do with it. And I think something to do with it is, you know, what I like to call corona fatigue. You know, I think everyone's just getting a little bit, including myself. I mean, we're getting a little bit tired of this inability to interact like we like to interact, you know, having to stay home or stay away from people and socially distance. I think a lot of that is what's attributing to this.
Yeah, corona fatigue. Is it okay if I use that? Can I repeat that, you know, in my daily discourse, you know, lamenting corona fatigue? You know.
As long as I get a bit of a royalty from it, I'm
I'll definitely attribute and extol the virtues of your expertise and everything that you do. You wear so many hats. This is Health Matters on listener-supported Red River Radio. I'm Dr. Randall Brewer. I'm your host, and my guest tonight is Dr. G.E. Golly. He is the Chancellor of LSU Health in Shreveport. You can call us at 1-800-552-8502 and ask us a question or offer a comment about this timely topic. You know, Dr. Golly, we were talking before the show, and I know you've had discussions with, you know, healthcare experts as well as, you know, some of the elements of leadership in our area and region. And one of the issues that's come up this week is the issue of, you know, wearing masks in public. And, you know, you mentioned, you know, there are a lot of things that we do that we may not want to do, like, you know, let's say stopping at a red light. You know, sometimes I really need to get to where I'm going, but there's a red light in front of me and I'd prefer for it to not be red. I'd prefer for it to be green, but I know I have to stop because that protects me and it protects the person that may be driving, you know, in a 90 degree angle to where I'm going. And you mentioned a couple of other examples. And one thing the mayor here, as well as the governor, has recommended is, you know, wearing a mask. You know, how would you convey to our listenership in terms of the importance of things like, you know, wearing a mask and listening to some of these guidance measures from health professionals?
Right, right. Well, again, you know, wearing a mask is super duper important. Look, I mean, you know. You and I were in the same medical school class, right? You know, some of your listeners don't know that. So, you know, we go back a long way. You know, you remember to this day, and even way back when, take the coronavirus out of it. If you had a leukemia patient or you had a patient that was severely immunosuppressed in some capacity, you put a mask on them. If they were going to get transferred from one part of the hospital to another part of the hospital, you put a mask on that patient. And really, that's a pretty good signal that although the primary purpose of the mask is to actually protect the people not wearing the mask, but wearing the mask also imparts some protection to you. How much of it, you know, can I cite you the exact article? No, but it only makes sense. It makes sense that if you're seeing someone that's about to cough, even if you're not wearing a mask, you turn away from them, you're less likely to inhale all the fomites and all the bad stuff that they're sneezing or coughing out. So if you're going to wear a mask or some kind of cloth over your face, it's going to impart some protection. Is it going to be as good as putting on a gas mask or putting on an N95 mask? No. But the reality is that it is going to protect you. And it's going to protect the people around you if you happen to have coronavirus and don't know about it. So let's not kid ourselves. The reality is that wearing a mask is cumbersome for a lot of people, particularly when the weather's hot. I mean, I've worn a mask on and off for the past 35 years. It's part of what I do. I'm a surgeon. I wear a mask. I wear a mask in the operating room. not because I'm afraid of catching something from the patient, but I don't want the patient that I'm operating on to catch something from me. That's why we wear a mask. The reality is that the mask does help. And so, you know, when you ask, you know, why do we need to use a mask? Well, I believe that a certain percentage, not 100%, but a certain percentage of the increase in cases that we're seeing, a certain percentage of the increase in the positivity of the test results that we're seeing, and a, certainly an increase in the hospitalizations. If we want to reduce the number of cases, reduce the positivity rate, and reduce the hospitalizations, wearing a mask is going to be a part of that puzzle. All right, Randy, another part of that puzzle is going to be meticulous hand washing, staying physically distanced by at least 6 feet. You know, those are all things that are going to help. And a mask is particularly important when you can't guarantee that you're going to be able to physically or socially distance from someone. So, you know, if I'm going to go walk the dog, am I going to wear a mask? No. If I'm going to go jogging, am I going to wear a mask? No. You know, if I'm going to get on an elevator, and I'm the only person on the elevator, I may not wear a mask, but as soon as someone gets on there, I'm going to put a mask on. But if obviously if I'm in a public place and I can't guarantee that I'm going to be able to socially distance from somebody, I'm going to wear a mask. You know, if I'm an immunosuppressed individual, I'm going to wear a mask. So again, you're right. There's a lot of things that we don't want to do. You know, but it's like I said before, you know, there's no shirt, you know, no shoes, no service. Everyone has seen that. Well, you know, no mask, no service. You know, that's a possibility. And the other thing a mask does is, remember, the easiest way to catch this is to be in proximity to somebody less than 6 feet and they sneeze or cough in your face. That's variable depending on what their viral load that individual has. But and the mask is going to help. But another way of catching it is if you are going to grab an inanimate object. Now, is the rate of passage as equal as somebody sneezing or coughing in your face? No, it's less than that. But again, if someone were to sneeze on a doorknob and you were to grab that doorknob, sneeze a minute later, grab that doorknob, or sneeze in their hand or cough in their hand, shake your hand. If you didn't do anything with your hand for an hour and somewhere in between washed your hands thoroughly, like we've talked about, sing happy birthday twice with warm water and soap, and you happen to stick your fingers in your mouth or in your nose, which you shouldn't do, but if you did that, you probably wouldn't get anything. But if you immediately took your hand and stuck it in your mouth or in your nose, you have a fairly good chance. Don't know what exact numbers are, but the chances are going to be better the sooner that you stick it in there in your mouth or in your nose. And a lot of that is time dependent. So one of the other things a mask does, if you're wearing a mask, it prevents you from sticking your hands in your mouth and in your nose. I mean, if you stick it in your ear, you're not going to get coronavirus. If you stick your finger in your cheek, you're not going to get coronavirus. You could possibly get it through your eyes, you know, because those are mucous membranes, but it's less likely through the eyes, most commonly through the nose or through the mouth.
You know, you mentioned, you know, it's important to wear a mask. You know, we talk about different levels of risk. And when it comes to, you know, wearing a mask and being, you know, diligent with it, you know, most people who are not used to wearing a mask, we're talking about wearing a mask when you go into, let's say, a grocery store or a retail store. The average time spent in those environments is maybe, you know, 30, 45 minutes, maybe up to an hour. I would venture to say you've probably worn a mask for maybe, what, 10 or 12 hours at a time? You're doing a mandibular reconstruction or doing some, you know, what we call them in medical school, you know, just commando procedures, you know, for these, you know, highly invasive tumors, you know, in the skull base. And so I would venture to say you've probably worn a mask for more than 12 hours at a time. How many times did you lose consciousness because your oxygen levels dropped too low? Or how many times did you have, you know, hypercarbia because you were re-inhaling your CO2 because you wore a mask too long. And so these, you know, these myths that we hear about, you know, not being able to actually breathe and exchange gases because we wear masks, need to be defunct. Would you agree? Or debunked?
I would agree with that. I mean, first of all, you know, there's masks and there's masks, right? You know, the scarf, which is an acceptable non-medical type of scenario. So, you know, if you're going into the hospital, then, you're talking about the minimum you're going to wear is a surgical mask. You're not going to wear like a scarf or something over your face or a cloth mask. Those are not acceptable for healthcare type settings. Even if you're going to visit someone in the hospital, which we're trying to minimize significantly now because of the pandemic. But even if you're going to go visit somebody in the hospital, a cloth mask is really not acceptable. You need to, you know, wear some type of surgical mask because those are better for that situation and they tend to be disposed of afterwards. But, you know, again, there's mask and there's mask. Now, you know, getting hypoxic or your oxygen level dropping as a result of wearing a mask is pretty much unheard of. I mean, I've stuck my finger on a pulse oximeter many times in the operating room wearing a mask, and there's really no change. I mean, you literally have to hold your breath for 30 seconds before the oxygen oxyhemoglobin disassociation curve shifts enough to the left in order to demonstrate any drop in your PaO2 or SaO2, your saturation. Now, there can be situations where you're wearing an N95 mask, which is a very different kind of mask, which has a much higher filtration rate. Those masks, if you wear them for a prolonged period of time, which no layperson is going to do that, that's going to be a medical setting. So when that in a medical setting, you know, the means of being able to manage that kind of situation are much better. But even in a medical setting, no one wears a tightly fitting N95 mask for a prolonged period of time. They all take breaks. I can imagine certain scenarios where if you had a very tight fitting N95 mask, you wouldn't necessarily become hypoxic, but you could potentially become hypercarbic, or your CO2 level may rise a little bit. You may get a little bit of a headache or something like that from that, but not to the level where you're going to be frankly disoriented or anything like that.
Yeah, so I think from what I'm hearing from you, the bottom line is, you know, what we're recommending, what the, you know, the state health department's recommending, what you're recommending is a cloth barrier. We don't even have to call it a mask. A cloth barrier, it's gonna catch a lot of those droplets as long as you're in a situation where you're not in close proximity to others. If you can't smell their breath, as a recent virologist on our show recommended, if you can smell someone's breath, you're probably too close. So if you can maintain that distance and put some sort of barrier, whether it's cloth or dry fit material or whatever it is, between you and that individual, you're going to mitigate the risk if the virus is there. And obviously symptomatic individuals, what are the current recommendations for testing? If someone thinks that they may have coronavirus, are we still recommending, getting tested as soon as possible, or if they've been exposed, sure, potentially?
Yeah, I'll just, if I can just comment on what you were saying right before that. Yeah, I mean, remember, getting the coronavirus, like any other virus, is not not an allergic reaction. Okay, it's not a anaphylaxis, you know. And remember, anaphylaxis is typically someone goes into shock, is not dose dependent. I mean, anaphylaxis happens because you're allergic to a very minute amount of something. It's not dose dependent. Things like these kind of viruses are really more dose dependent. You have to get a certain load of the virus. That's why our EVT lab here that Dr. Kevel and Dr. Sapp are running, this emerging viral threat lab, really has the ability to measure not just qualitatively, but quantitatively what type of viral load that particular patient has. So we measure and they have a really high viral load. That's an individual that really needs to be quarantined for a minimum of 2 weeks. And possibly if they're that high of a viral load, retested. So, you know, that's very important, a concept that, you know, this is not a, this is more of a dose dependent. And because it's dose dependent, wearing a mask will reduce the ability of that virus to get in. Doesn't mean that one or two particles of virus getting in, that's not going to cause it. The estimation, you know, the literature shows at least 1,000 viral particles to become symptomatic or to actually be able to spread it to another patient and for that virus to multiply. So you get a few viral particles, that's not going to make that much of a difference. What was your other question, Randy? Now that I forgot.
Oh, yeah. I mean, with regards, you know, to the mask and things along the lines of, you know, recommending social distancing, you know, what are the recommendations now with regards to if, let's say, you know, I'm in contact with someone who's been tested and they're positive, or I've got some symptoms, you know, the symptom complex for coronavirus infection right now, it ranges from nothing, right? A little bit of nausea, maybe a headache, no fever, all the way to a full-blown, you know, storm of catecholamines and, you know, cytokines and lots of, you know, fever and chills and things along those lines. So are there any updates with regards to testing recommendations as well as, you know, do contacts of people who have tested positive for the virus with or without symptoms, have the testing recommendations changed as we, you know, march through this, you know, this period?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's a good question. And some of the criteria has changed, you know, over time, and I think it will continue to change. You know, the problem with testing is that test is only good for that time that it was tested. And depending on how long it takes you to get the results back. Now, you take the rapid tester that Abbott has, gives you a result in 15 minutes, you know, 5 minutes or so. If it's positive, it'll give you a positive. If you're negative, it'll take, you know, about 10 to 15 minutes to give you that result. Now, that'll tell you right then that you're negative or positive. But you know, as soon as you walk out that door, you know, you could get reinfected. The other thing to make note of is that for the most part, it makes no sense to get, if you think you had a contact with someone that has coronavirus, it's usually not going to show up on any kind of test for a minimum of 72 hours after the contact, after the exposure. More than likely 96 hours. So waiting 3 or 4 days to get tested. So if you get tested the day after you think you had a contact and the test comes back negative, that test doesn't mean anything. It means that 3 or 4 days ago you didn't have an exposure, but it may not mean that the exposure you had yesterday just hasn't had a chance it hasn't gotten to the point where the incubation period is such that it's going to present itself with any positivity on the test. So in that case, you may end up with a false negative test result. So, you know, in as a general rule, it makes very little sense to test somebody unless they're symptomatic. As a general rule, even if you've had an exposure with someone, it depends on what that degree of exposure is. So a significant exposure would be an exposure where you're not wearing a mask and you've been in direct contact or less than 6 feet from somebody for a sustained period of time of 15 minutes or greater. So, you know, if you're talking about, you know, you were on the same elevator or you were in the same room with somebody, but you're on the other side of the room and you were wearing a mask and you you did proper hand hygiene and proper social distancing, that's not an indication that you need to be tested.
It's an interesting question. I had an issue just come up recently where, a kid was at camp, they choked on something, and so they took them to the hospital, and the kid was not symptomatic, had no fever or anything, but they tested them for coronavirus.
Right.
The kid was positive.
Right. Right.
And so everybody at the camp sent home, and they tell the parents, test your kid if you feel like they're at risk for coronavirus. And all the kids were together. There's no social distancing in summer camp, right? So these types of scenarios are just going to be, innumerous in terms of coming up, in terms of who needs to be tested and how often. And so I think your comments are really important in terms of, symptomatic testing obviously needs to be performed, but, the contact tracing and contact testing, what do we do with that?
Right. And it's hard, and I can't say it. I don't want people to say, golly, saying this, golly, saying that. The reality is that, what are you going to do if you get a positive test versus a negative test? And how do you practically or pragmatically look at the situation? I'm not saying that you shouldn't occasionally test asymptomatic people. You should. We have to know what the incidence is. So there's some value in testing asymptomatic people, but the actual practicality of testing everybody is probably not necessary. And the reality is when you do test somebody, it is only good for that period that you tested them. And the crazy thing is it makes no sense to test somebody that you think is possibly positive. And unless you're able to have a rapid return on the test, like within, 15 minutes, 45 minutes, whatever, if you test somebody, you ought to send them home and isolate them. Because if it's going to take 4 or 5 days for that test to come back, they could potentially infect a lot of people. So what is the purpose of getting the test? So, you have to sort of look at that. And also you have to look at what that individual that you're testing, what do they do? What kind of occupation do they have? What's the chance that they're going to potentially expose somebody to coronavirus? Is this an individual that has a lot of contact with nursing home patients? In that situation, yes, you ought to get tested. Even if you're, asymptomatic, maybe you should be tested every 2 weeks. That's sort of a high risk category. Maybe if you're a dentist and you're that close to people working with somebody like that, then they should maybe be tested frequently. I don't really know what the right answer for all that is. But as a general rule, we're pretty much testing symptomatic individuals unless there is a particular reason to test an asymptomatic individual. And having a casual contact is really not an indication for that. Now, if that patient develops a fever or develops one of these signs or symptoms of, loss of taste, loss of smell, nausea, diarrhea, as you said earlier, it's a very wide array of potential presentations. But the safest thing to do, socially distance, wear a mask, do proper hygiene, assume that everyone has coronavirus until proven otherwise. And ultimately there's going to be a vaccine that presents that we can use, and hopefully it'll be before the springtime.
Yeah, absolutely. And, I'm going to remind everybody again, this is Health Matters on listener-supported Red River Radio. I'm Dr. Randall Brewer. I'm your host tonight, and our guest is Dr. G.E. Ghali, Chancellor of LSU Health Sciences here in Shreveport. Dr. Ghali, we talked, last time about school and, what to do with, we were both cautiously optimistic about, the virus not really being as hardy as we have learned that it may be with regards to the summer and what's going to happen with school starting in the fall. And the fall is really rapidly approaching us. I think schools slated to start in maybe about 5 weeks in most of the region. You know, what measures do we think need to happen in terms of making, you know, kids returning to a live educational environment a reality? Because we know distance learning is probably, you know, not ready for prime time, you know. And as, you know, as a healthcare practitioner, you'd think that, you know, we've got it together, you and I and others of us who tried to do the distanced medical care there for 4 to 6 weeks, right, with telehealth. And I can tell you, you know, I'll admit my own fallacies. I just don't think the quality is there. You know, in a digital environment, you know, I think the level of attention is not the same. I think the level of emphasis on the connection between the student and the pupil and maybe the doctor and the patient is not the same, you know, when you're in physical space. And so I agree, you know, and I think a lot of educators will as well, that in-person teaching needs to happen at some point. But how do we make that safe?
Yeah, well, you know, it's a good question, and you know, and we kind of struggled with this ourselves here at the Health Science Center, and you know, we've got the, as most people know, let's just take the medical school. You know, we have three schools here, but if we just take the medical school, you know, the first 2 years are pretty much classroom and the last 2 years are pretty much clinical stuff. And, you know, in the hospital and in clinics and things like that. You know, we reinstituted the clinical component of the training. The students that are in the first and second year medical school classes are still doing their stuff remotely, you know, getting lectures and things like that remotely. It's not ideal, but it's probably the safest thing to do right now. My intent is to start them back in the fall. I think that should be the intent of everyone from, you know, kindergarten or preschool through high school into the universities, colleges and universities. I mean, clearly, there's a lot of reasons, maybe less so in college and the universities compared to, say, elementary, middle school, and high school. There's a lot of reasons why we need to get back. I mean, education obviously is very important. Homeschooling is good, but again, and there are some limitations, just like there are some limitations to, you know, attending regular school. But, you know, the reality is that there's a lot of economic reasons. You know, parents got to work. Sometimes both parents have to work. If a kid's lucky enough to have a mom and dad both, at least one of them has to work. Most of the time, both of them have to work. There's a nutritional component to it, right? You know, a lot of kids, the best meal they get, I hate to say it, is at school, you know, and at least they're going to know that they're going to get that one square meal. School is a kind of a safe spot for a lot of kids, right? You know, they've got a principal there, they've got teachers that they trust. There's some validity in the fact that, maybe rates of child abuse, neglect and things like that are certainly various psychosocial issues, depression, some psychiatric and behavioral health issues may be on the rise with lack of schooling. Some of that may be stress on the kids' part. Some of that may be stress on the parents' part or the grandparents. The grandparents are a whole nother enigma with this, because that's the population that may get obligated to take care of the kids, which again, you know, that's great, you know, but the grandparents are the ones that are more susceptible to getting the coronavirus from asymptomatic children that may be carrying it around. So there's a lot of reasons why we got to get back to school. Not the least which that education is probably the most important core fundamental crown jewel of getting out of poverty and getting things moving. You know this, Randy, it's important. you know, education is the key to success, in at least in my mind. So it's important that we get back to school and we reopen the schools. And how do we do that safely is your question. Again, a great question. I don't think there's going to be, there's always a risk in school. There's been a risk way of getting everything from head, from lice in your hair to catching the mumps to getting, you know, mononucleosis to getting strep infections. I mean, there's always a risk. Universities, colleges, and schools have always been a risk because it's more of a, it's sort of a congregate kind of situation. So it's never going to be completely risk-free. So what we have to do is try to mitigate it. And what I've told my leadership here at the school, and as well as those that I've spoken to in the community, is that, look, you know, temperature checks, having plenty of hand sanitizer around. Every time a kid needs to go to the bathroom, they need to use the hand sanitizer before they go. They need to wash in the bathroom, and they have, need to have hand sanitizer when they come back. Maybe a better idea to keep the kids put in the class and move, rotate the teachers around, you know, instead of rotating the students around. If, you know, they're taking temperatures and someone ends up being febrile, they need to go home, and they need to go home and self-isolate, get a COVID test. That would be considered a symptomatic criteria. If they're positive, then they probably need to stay home for the next 10 to 14 days. So there has to be some modality for them to do some remote learning as well, possibly. Lunches and cafeterias, you know, they probably need to look at serving individual meals in little packages versus going through a buffet line. Trying to spend a lot of times outdoors where we know the virus is less prone outdoors, where there's better ventilation. So there's a lot of things that can be done, I think. You know, I would be more concerned about the teachers than the students, because the students most of the time are going to be fairly, they're not going to be so prone to developing serious complications, but they're going to be prone to spreading it. I would be afraid of the teachers catching it as well, because, you know, there's a lot less bench strength when it comes to teachers. Plus, they're more susceptible to it because most of them are. Many of them are in that category of getting it. But remember this, guys, the number one increased number in Louisiana is the 18 to 29 age group. That's the number one. You know, there's over 15,000 to 16,000 cases right now. The highest category is the 18 to 29 in Louisiana that are becoming COVID positive. Now, that's not the highest category for deaths, thankfully, but that's the highest category for positivity. So those are the ones that are going to be likely to spread it to the older populations. And that's the result of congregating in bars, in restaurants, and these things that the governor has, Governor Edwards has mentioned in the last few days.
Yeah, since you mentioned statistics, how are we doing with regards to, you know, you mentioned positive tests, but obviously we need to think about what's our hospitalization rate doing and what's our mortality rate doing?
Yeah.
Here locally.
Yeah, locally. Well, I mean, it's a good question. And I'll tell you, you know, we've done close to 900,000 tests. Almost, you know, we're approaching a million tests in Louisiana. The overall positivity rate in the state's about 8.2%, you know, close to 8.2%. If you look at just in Region 7, you know, which is really our region here in this part of the state, looking at the total number of beds available. Let me see. I've got it written down here. Yeah, because I'll tell you, we have about 15,000 or so beds available in Louisiana. Our occupancy rate right now, our capacity, overall capacity that's being used now is about 65%. So we've got some capacity, but again, Randy, some parts of the state are a little bit more harder hit than others. So we're looking at total bed capacity. Ventilatory capacity, we have about 1,500 vents that are available. We have additional portable vents, but if you look just at Region 7, which is sort of Caddo Parish, Shreveport-Bossier, Caddo Parish area, we have 70%+ of our hospital ventilators that are available right now. So,
That's great news.
It is great news, and I think that there's two different issues. The rate of hospitalization is going up. I mean, let's just give you an example. If you look at a week ago, a week ago we were looking at a total around 700. Let's take a week ago. We were looking at 700 patients admitted into the hospital that were COVID positive in Louisiana. Right now, as of today, we're looking at almost 1,100, about 1,050 patients that are admitted. So, you know, we're getting close to doubling the number of hospitalizations. Now, in those numbers that are being hospitalized, more and more of them are in the 18 to 29 category. And also, interestingly, we're not seeing quite a rise in the ventilatory rate as we did before, number of patients placed on ventilators. The critical care doctors across the entire state are doing a much better job of early management of these patients, not getting them intubated so early. Steroids, I think, are being used now. Dr. Conrad and Dr. Scott here, I've talked to them quite a bit lately. They're instituting intravenous steroid therapy, which has been around for years, as you know, on these patients. And they believe that it's modulating the immune response and not as severe of a cytokine storm that's going on. So we're getting better at managing these patients, and that's helping. But overall, the number of hospitalizations are going up. Louisiana right now is still number five in the state in cases per capita. Number five in the country in cases per capita, number 10 in the country in total death rate, and number eight in number of new cases. So we've been hovering somewhere between, anywhere from number three to number 10 in number of new cases over the past week. And, so that's really not a very good indication. So the trajectory that we're going on is not the trajectory that we would like to see. So hopefully we'll be able to get a little bit of a better response to some of these issues related to mitigating this with wearing masks until we can get a vaccine.
You know, it sounds to me like a couple of things are going on with regards to perhaps keeping mortality at bay. You've got a younger population with more reserve, and you've got more treatment options. The toolbox continues to be filled with, you know, evidence-based treatment protocols like remdesivir. You mentioned corticosteroids and maybe, you know, hyperimmune plasma. So it sounds like we're learning better about how to treat it, and thankfully, you know, a healthier population are being exposed relative to the vulnerable population, which I think if I can extrapolate, they got the message. If you're older, if you've got, you know, COPD, if you've got diabetes, hypertension, if you had some heart attacks, you don't need to be mixing around in places where you could get this virus.
Right.
And so at least with the patients that I talk to, you know, I sort of wrap my visits up every day. So, you know, Mr. or Mrs. So-and-so, what are you doing to stay away from the virus? And it's pretty universal in my population where they're like, we're staying away from contact with people that, you know, we are not guaranteed that are practicing safety measures with regards to their health.
No, I would agree with that, Dr. Brewer. I think the more senior population, they get it, they understand. I think it's the older the younger population is having the issues.
No doubt. This is Dr. Randall Brewer, and we're listening to Health Matters here on listener-supported Red River Radio. We are with Dr. G.E. Golly. He is the Chancellor of LSU Health Sciences Center here in Shreveport, Louisiana. We are discussing no other than the current COVID-19 pandemic. You can call us with any questions or comments you might have about this topic at 1-800-552-8502, or you can tweet at RRR Public Radio. Dr. Ghaly, you know, we got some information together to sort of run by you to see what you thought about some of the statistics that have been collected over the, you know, course of this pandemic here locally, nationally, and across the world. And one of the issues that comes up is the idea of seroprevalence, or, you know, if a vaccine doesn't come up, you know, come into fruition quickly as we would like it to be, will we develop natural immunity, herd immunity, as it were, with regards to a population? Since we do have so many positive cases, it would make sense that can't we just get past this and, you know, maybe corona fatigue will transmit into, you know, corona preventive immunity. But as it turns out, in Spain, over 60,000 people who were tested for antibodies, they only found 5% seroprevalence of coronavirus seroprevalence or immunity to the virus. And I know LSU is performing through the ICANN College of Medicine in New York antibody testing. Tell us a little bit, if you can, about what has antibody testing taught us here about our seroprevalence, and is it a useful tool to detect, you know, where this virus is going, and if antibodies are, you know, meaningful with regards to how we behave going forward?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a good question, and I think what it's really told us is that it's not as prevalent. The immune response that develops adequate antibodies is not as prevalent as we thought it was. And so what I mean by that is it does not seem as though the number of patients that we're testing, again, we've tested much less. You know, we've tested around 35 to 40,000 patients right now in our EVT lab. With the viral, with the RT-PCR test, we've tested a fraction of that with antibodies, and we're not finding that the antibodies are as prevalent as we thought that they would be. And again, we don't know whether, you know, qualitatively that how well that is going to impart significant immunity to that particular individual or not. So I would say the jury is still out related to seropositivity and its ability to really produce a long-term immunity. I think that, wisdom would say that, yes, you know, someone is going to be immune to getting it a second time if they've had it once. But again, I think the jury is still pretty much out with that.
So with regards to testing in general, if someone is, you know, potentially exposed to the test, or they have concerns, you know, what are the parameters that should be considered at the present time with regards to both, you know, virus or antigen testing versus antibody testing?
So, if someone is exposed again to someone with coronavirus,
yeah, as you mentioned earlier, you're recommending pretty much, you know, symptomatic individuals need to be tested, but with regards to community antibody testing, should individuals, you know, seek antibody testing if they've not developed any symptoms or a history of symptoms?
Well, I think it sort of depends. I mean, it depends, again, what type of occupation they have and what their susceptibility to exposure is. I think it's a good idea if they work in a high risk category of like we did antibody testing. Pretty much on the majority of the faculty, students, and staff here at the Health Science Center, because frankly they're in somewhat of a high risk category, being involved in the hospital and in patient care and with or without contact with COVID patients. So it's really not a bad idea, again, for certain populations to get the antibody testing. But again, I want to emphasize that you look at the literature, look at the science, and the epidemiologist will tell you that most coronaviruses that you get does impart some immunities to some degree. But how long that lasts, is really not known at this point.
Is the current antibody testing sensitive and also specific for the, you know, the SARS coronavirus type 2 that is responsible for the current illness? I've heard that argument with regards to, well, if I get antibody tested, if I'm positive, it could mean that I got another coronavirus, before. Yeah. Does that mean that I'm really protected from the current COVID-19 disease?
Right, that's true. The test that we have here is very specific for that within the EBT lab.
Excellent information. Let's jump to therapy and preventives again. You know, we mentioned, corticosteroids. You mentioned them as being something that is potentially helpful. Comment, if you will, with regards to an update on hydroxychloroquine as well as remdesivir and nitric oxide as treatments. And if you will, in the last couple of minutes that we have, you know, give us what information that you have with regards to vaccine development here locally, right, as well as nationally.
Right. Well, you know, you mentioned the nitric oxide, the inhaled nitric oxide. You know, that was and we developed the partnership with Harvard and the University of Alabama in Birmingham and Uppsala University in Sweden. And the Health Science Center here is participating in a study evaluating the effects of nitric oxide as a possible treatment for COVID-19. We talked about this before. And nitric oxide has been previously shown to improve blood flow in the lungs, and it may also have direct virucidal properties. This is given as a gas, and it's readily available, and it can be used in almost all hospitals. We have about 100 people enrolled presently in this study here at the Health Science Center. We're second only to the to Massachusetts General Hospital at Harvard. We're second only to them in the number of participants that we have enrolled in this important study. There's also an arm to this, which is the mild to moderate arm. You know, that's the severe arm. The mild to moderate arm of the study is closed, and the data is currently being evaluated for publication and submission to the Food and Drug Administration to enter a phase 2 clinical trial. The inhaled nitric oxide is also being used to treat patients with ARDS, as you probably know. We mentioned also the convalescent plasma therapy, and that is a collaboration with the Mayo Clinic up in Rochester, and we were one of the first centers in the country to deliver this convalescent plasma therapy, and I think it was highlighted recently on the CBS Evening News as well. And the convalescent plasma therapy is an experimental treatment that we've been using for people with severe COVID-19. People that have recovered from COVID-19, as you mentioned earlier, that have antibodies, which are proteins in the body used to fight off infections. The blood from these people who've recovered is called convalescent plasma. And the convalescent plasma, the plasma is the liquid portion of the blood, right? And it's the part of the blood, the part that's not red in color once you've centrifuged it. The researchers, we hope that the convalescent plasma, when it's given to people with COVID-19, will boost their ability to fight the virus. It may also help keep people who are moderately ill from becoming more ill and experiencing COVID-19 complications. So if you've had COVID-19 and you've recovered from it, I would highly consider that you donate blood through this program, which is a collaborate between LSU and LifeShare blood centers. And it's a very good deal.
Dr. Ghaly, we really appreciate your time tonight. It's always good to be with you.
Hey, I'm honored to be here, Dr. Brewer. And I want to thank everybody for listening and, doing your part to help. Nobody wants to wear a mask, but I really think that it's something that we have to do, particularly when you cannot socially distance. Please do your part, and God bless everybody.
Dr. Ghaly, again, LSU Health Sciences Center and School of Medicine Chancellor here, we thank you so much. Be safe and be well, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Thank you, my friend.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
You can find more information on COVID-19 at coronavirus.gov. I'm Dr. Randall Brewer. I've been your host tonight. This program will be available for podcast at www.redriverradio.org. You can also find updates on COVID-19 for Arkansas, Louisiana, and Texas at our homepage, redriverradio.org. Health Matters is a production of Red River Radio. Our producer is Renee Moran. We would like to thank Mr. Kermit Poland tonight, as well as Mr. Wally Derleth, for providing their assistance this evening. Views and opinions expressed on Health Matters may not reflect those of the station, LSUS, or its staff. Health Matters has been made possible in part by the Noel Foundation, as well as the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. I'm Dr. Randall Brewer, and thank you so much for being part of our audience this evening, and tune in next Thursday for another edition of Health Matters here on listener-supported Red River Radio.
Still, when I think of the road we're traveling on, I wonder what's gone wrong. Can't help but I wonder what's gone wrong. I dreamed I was dying. I dreamed that my soul rose unexpectedly, looking back down at me, smiled reassuringly. And I dreamed I was flying high up above. My eyes could clearly see the Statue of Liberty sailing away to sea. And I dreamed of flying. When we come on a ship they call the Mayflower, we come on a ship that sailed the moon. We come in the ages most uncertain hours and sing an American tune. Oh,